I'm Dori Smith for Regime Change Radio, a half-hour program on the importance of voting to bring about regime change in America. Today, part two of an interview with law professor Marjorie Cohn.
We need a regime change, and we need a government that will represent the people and will provide the people with medical care, with Social Security benefits, with infrastructure that we need in this country, and stop making so much mischief in other countries.
Marjorie Cohn is the Executive Vice President of the National Lawyers Guild and Professor of Law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law. A leader in her field, she has worked on the issue of gay rights within the U.S. military. She is an editor at the legal magazine Juris, and she took a team to the 8th Inter-American Moot Court Competition in 2003. Marjorie Cohn's work can be found in various publications and at www.nhlg.org. We pick up our discussion with Professor Cohn about prisoners being held at Guantanamo.
Well, the Guantanamo issue is really a disturbing one because for nearly 2 years now there are 660 prisoners there. They've been incarcerated there, kept in small cages with no charges against them, without access to their families, and without access to attorneys. And the Cuban government just this week has called what is happening on their in their territory of Guantanamo Bay a concentration camp. And that those words have also been echoed by other organizations such as the National Lawyers Guild and the American Association of Jurists. Both of those organizations have called for the closure of the concentration camp at Guantanamo Bay. Nearly half the prisoners there are interrogated every week in sessions lasting up to 16 hours. And a prisoner that was released in May told Amnesty International that the interrogations were like torture. An Australian lawyer said on ABC Radio that the prisoners had been subjected to good old-fashioned torture as people would have understood it in the Dark Ages. And he said that one of the prisoners had described being taken out and tied to a post and having rubber bullets fired at them, and they were being made to kneel cruciform in the sun until they collapsed. The Red Cross recently concluded a two-month visit to Guantanamo and is very concerned that the U.S. authorities have basically placed those prisoners beyond the law. They still have no idea about their fate, no means of recourse through any legal mechanism, and the Red Cross observed a worrying deterioration in the psychological health of a large number of them. And the New York Times reported 32 suicides in 18 months, and several of the prisoners were treated, have been treated for clinical depression. What's happened is that the Bush administration has denied these prisoners access to U.S. courts to challenge their detention, disingenuously claiming that the U.S. is not sovereign over Guantanamo Bay. And they point to a treaty and a lease that goes back to 1903, where Cuba, the then Cuban government, gave the United States the right to use Guantanamo Bay, but the use was exclusively for a coaling or naval station and not for any other purpose, and that's what the lease says. And nothing gave the United States the ability to use Guantanamo Bay as a prison camp. But the Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals ruled last week, or 2 weeks ago, that U.S. courts do have jurisdiction to hear complaints from these prisoners. And so the U.S. Supreme Court actually has decided to review this issue, and in this present term, by June, we should have a ruling from the U.S. Supreme Court about whether or not the prisoners at Guantanamo Bay can actually file writs of habeas corpus in U.S. courts.
Let's try to envision, if we can, what the trial of Saddam Hussein would be like and how it would have an impact on U.S. foreign policy at the time it was going on. Saddam Hussein, first of all, before the invasion, was being accused of having illegal weapons of mass destruction, which have not been found. He claimed to not have weapons of mass destruction. And so let's talk a little bit about what you've been writing about the various resolutions and how they would apply to his defense and to our prosecution.
Well, you notice that our government has not been talking about the weapons of mass destruction. That was the main topic of discussion in the period of time leading up to the so-called Operation Iraqi Freedom, but we haven't heard about it since. And Saddam Hussein handed over documents and said, we don't have any weapons of mass destruction, and of course we know that no weapons of mass destruction have been found. And that was the basis for the invasion. Now, the focus has been deflected to Saddam Hussein's war crimes, crimes against humanity, against the Iraqi, the Iranians and the Kurds, and atrocities committed in Iraq against the Iraqi people. We don't hear anything about the weapons of mass destruction because there aren't any, and certainly it looks like there aren't any because none have been found. So the subject has been changed. The Bush administration has changed the subject and focused now on what a tyrant Saddam Hussein was. And, you know, if you look at it, yes, he certainly was a tyrant, as was Pinochet in Chile, as was the Shah in Iran, all of whom were supported, actually put into power by the U.S. after the CIA assassinated or otherwise disappeared democratically elected leaders. And the United States government has supported other dictators who have been brutal dictators when it has been in their economic and geopolitical interests, at least they perceived it to be. So by changing the subject and saying, well, yeah, maybe there weren't any weapons of mass destruction, but he's a horrible dictator, that doesn't justify or legitimize this war, and it certainly doesn't justify the deaths of Americans or British or Iraqis or anyone else. These people are dying for no reason at all. Actually, there is a reason, but it's not the reason we were given, and it's just really an outrage.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because I know you've written about oil as it relates to both Afghanistan and Iraq and the U.S. interests in those regions.
Yes, well, Saudi Arabia has really been a major ally of the United States. In fact, George Bush Sr. has many business dealings with the monarchy in Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia has been a major source of oil supply for the United States and also a place where there have been significant military U.S. military bases. But Saudi Arabia is becoming very unstable because of Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden, and 15 of the 19 hijackers were from Saudi Arabia, the September 11th hijackers. So what has happened is that the U.S. has pulled its bases out of Saudi Arabia, put them in Qatar, and is now building permanent military bases in Iraq. This is a big reason why we're in Iraq right now, is to get those military bases, not only for access to cheap oil and to get out from under the reliance on Saudi Arabian oil and Saudi's influence over OPEC, which sets the oil prices, but also as a way to control the area, to have the U.S. be dominant in the Middle East and in Central Asia, and taking over Afghanistan serves the same function. Shortly before September 11th, the Bush administration was negotiating with the Taliban for an oil pipeline to run through Pakistan and Afghanistan with the big oil companies. And shortly after September 11th, and shortly after the invasion, the war in Afghanistan, which was also not approved by the Security Council and was also not in self-defense and was also violative of international law, the pipeline deal went through. And so if you look at a document which was authored under the direction of Paul Wolfowitz, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, in the early 90s and was leaked by the New York Times, it was a Pentagon planning defense guidance. It says very explicitly that the United States will not have any challenge to its will not allow any challenge to its leadership in the Middle East, in Central Asia, and so we're really talking about not just access to oil, which is part of it, but also making sure that China and Russia and no other countries challenge our power and hegemony as the sole remaining superpower in the world.
Now, you were speaking before of the likelihood of a draft, and now it seems you're talking about America setting up a large array of bases in an area where we are not welcome. It looks like we're in for protracted and possibly wider war. Do you think that under the circumstances, what we're looking at can be effectively challenged by the international community of professionals like yourself who know international law and can call the White House to task for these policies that are so endangering all of us?
Well, you know, we can write our articles and we can speak out on shows such as yours, but the fact of the matter is that the U.S. government is the most powerful government in the world, and it's not going to say, oh, you're absolutely right, we'll stop doing all these horrible things. In my opinion, what we need in November is a regime change, not in Iraq and not in Afghanistan and not in Iran and not in Syria and not in Saudi Arabia, but in the United States of America. We need a regime change, and we need a government that will represent the people and will provide the people with medical care, with Social Security benefits, with infrastructure that we need in this country, and stop making so much mischief in other countries, which doesn't benefit the people in those countries or the people in this country, but just benefits the big corporations. And that's what we need. And there are many, many people who are mobilizing to make sure that there is a regime change in November. There's an organization called MoveOn.org, which is very, very influential in raising money with small contributions from thousands and thousands of people to try to really make our democracy work. And so I would encourage people to go to the polls and vote, but also to really educate themselves about what this government of ours is doing in our name, and think about what would happen if the draft came back and if our boys were forced to go and be in harm's way, which is what Bush certainly would have them do. It's very, very disturbing. And so people need to get together. They need to speak out. They need to contact their representatives and their congresspeople. They need to write letters to the editor, and they need to hold community forums and talk about what it really means to be in a democracy and how we're going to make that happen in November.
And you're listening to Regime Change Radio. I'm Dori Smith. We're talking to attorney Marjorie Cohn. She's a professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego and the executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild. Marjorie, as you look at the foreign policies of this White House and try to envision how you would be describing or making a case about the violations of international law you've seen and about how to argue, let's say, on behalf of shutting this occupation down and turning things around, how would you begin? I mean, what kinds of things can you cite as gross violations?
Well, first of all, Bush's policy of preemptive war violates the United Nations Charter. In the first place, there clearly was no danger to preempt in Iraq. There was nothing to prevent. There was no imminent threat to the United States or even to the to any other member of the United Nations. And so the doctrine of preemptive war actually violates the UN Charter because the UN Charter does not allow for preventative or preemptive action. It only allows for action that is sanctioned or approved by the Security Council or taken in self-defense. And taken in self-defense means that there is an imminent threat to a member country of the UN, and that did not occur. In terms of the occupation that is going on in Iraq now, with the occupying authority being the U.S. and Britain, that occupation has been validated by the Security Council after the countries of the Security Council had their arms severely twisted by the Bush administration. Nevertheless, I would argue that the occupation is illegal. The Security Council has gone beyond its authority in legitimizing the occupation of a country which was illegally invaded. And in my opinion, what should happen immediately is that the administration of Iraq should be turned over to the United Nations, and the occupiers should leave. It's also become very, very clear that the corporations who have been given the major, really, really fat, juicy contracts to rebuild Iraq are the big corporations which have supported the Republican Party and George W. Bush and Cheney's old corporation Halliburton, which it turns out has been gouging U.S. taxpayers of $61 million, overcharging us for delivering fuel to Iraq. And Halliburton got that contract without even having to bid for it. It wasn't even open to other corporations to bid for. And then, shortly before Saddam Hussein was arrested, Wolfowitz, the Assistant Secretary of Defense, released a document which said, or put it on a website, and it was picked up, and that document said that countries which had not supported the U.S. In going to war against Iraq would not be allowed to bid for the other reconstruction contracts. And there was a big hue and cry, and then shortly after that, the representative from George W. Bush, who was trying to get the countries which had debts owed to them by Iraq, went around to different countries and made deals with them and basically said, from what we can tell, if you agree to forgive your debt that Iraq, you know, all the money that Iraq owes you, then we will consider you, your corporations, as you know, eligible to bid on these contracts. So there's all this wheeling and dealing going on at the very, very high levels of government in the interest of the very big corporations. And the people in this country and the people of Iraq are going to be the losers. So I think that it's very important for people to understand that.
Do you think that some of what the United States has done will come out, no matter what kind of legal process goes on now in Iraq having to do with this trial of Saddam Hussein?
You know, that depends on who controls the media and who manipulates the media and who has the most money to manipulate the media. The Democrats are in a wonderful position to try to make this public. Unfortunately, they're spending a lot of their time fighting against each other and attacking Dean, because Gore came out and supported in support of Dean, and giving the Bush administration all kinds of cannon fodder then to come out and attack Dean if he ultimately becomes the candidate. And so I think that these Democratic candidates are passing up a golden opportunity to point out what's happening in Iraq, what our government is doing, and I would like to see them stop bickering among themselves and start educating the public about what's really happening there.
Finally, when you look at the whole issue of the various countries that are now looking at whether or not they will join America in trying to secure Iraq and join America in, let's say, trying to support the UN and calling for elections, do you see any kind of hopeful thing on the horizon that might work to shut down the violence in Iraq?
Well, I think that I don't know if I'm optimistic about this, but I think that if the UN really were allowed to take over, that things could be put back together and institutions could be built. But as long as the people there perceive that the United States is pulling the strings and calling the shots, that's not going to happen. Another thing is that if Saddam Hussein faces the death penalty, which he likely will if he's tried in Iraq, there is going to be a tremendous outcry by countries in Europe, for example, and in many other countries which have abolished the death penalty. And the United States is really the only Western democracy that still has the death penalty. And that's another reason why Bush has already come out and said that in so many words that he thinks Saddam Hussein ought to get the death penalty. And of course, you know, Bush was, when he was governor of Texas, he was responsible for executing more people than all the other states combined. So he's a real fan of the death penalty, but unfortunately the direction of the international community, the other democracies, and also many countries that are not democracies, in addition to the international tribunals, have abolished the death penalty. And so I think that that will really anger other countries if that happens. That remains to be seen.
Now, we are recording this on New Year's Eve, and as we speak, the United States is at a very high level of alert regarding terrorist activity in the world that might actually come here and hurt us. And we've seen an awful lot of it in the past year in other countries, and terribly tragic events have occurred. But it sounds as if the Bush administration has not taken into consideration how its words and deeds impact people and how their reactions work in the sense of, if they're claiming that they're going to kill him already, they haven't even tried him, they don't even know where they're going to try him. Don't you think it pushes people's buttons and in that way encourages terrorist thinking?
I think so. I mean, the September 11th attacks were tragic, and they were crimes against humanity, and the people who were responsible for them should be brought to justice. But by attacking Afghanistan and killing thousands of people in Afghanistan and Iraq, that just creates more and more resentment against the United States. And in fact, we see the terrorism in Iraq increasing. Al-Qaeda was not operating in Iraq before we invaded Iraq. And now Osama bin Laden has evidently given orders to leave Afghanistan and go into Iraq and operate there. And so when people in the Arab world watch pictures of broken bodies of children and women, bleeding bodies, dead bodies, that infuriates them. They get even more angry at the United States, and that makes us as Americans even more vulnerable to acts of terrorism.
Let's close by inviting listeners to find your work online and read about international and human rights law issues.
Well, there is a website where I have a number of articles, and that website is http://jurist.law.pitt.edu/forum. And I'll say that again, http://jurist.law.pitt.edu/forum. There's also another website which is very good, and that is the National Lawyers Guild website, which is www.nlg.org. And there is a lot of information there about how people can get involved in working on committees and networking with other people who are working for social change and social justice.
Marjorie Cohn, thank you so much for joining us on Regime Change Radio.
My pleasure, Dory, and I really do hope we have a regime change in November in Washington, D.C.
Marjorie Cohn is a professor of law at Thomas Jefferson School of Law in San Diego and the executive vice president of the National Lawyers Guild. If you have been concerned about your status as relates to a possible U.S. military draft or your rights while serving in the U.S. military, you can obtain information by logging on to the Center on Conscience and War at www.nisbcco.org. That's nisbcco.org. Or the website of the American Friends Service Committee at afsc.org. That's afsc.org. You can also call the hotline for the GI Rights Organization and the Center on Conscience and War at 1-800-483-2220. That number again, 1-800-483-2220. For Regime Change Radio, I'm Dory Smith. This program was produced in the studios of listener-supported WHUS Stores, Radio for the People. If you would like to comment on this program or learn more about this topic, write to me at rcrradio@aol.com. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or the University of Connecticut.